Welcome to the Big Web Show. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. Today's Big Web Show is brought to you by HappyCog Hosting. HappyCog Hosting is industrial-grade, optimized LAMP stack hosting for high-traffic sites. Visit us at happycoghosting.com or call 855-COG-HOST. That's 855-COG-HOST to find out more about hosting done the HappyCog way. And we are here with one of the most impressive and humble human beings I know, a very talented guy. I think he's still in his early 30s and has accomplished quite a bit. It's Josh Williams, most recently a CEO of Gowalla, the amazing and beautiful check-in app, which was recently acquired by Facebook. Prior to that, he was the CEO of he was the founder of BlinkSale, the invoicing software that every freelancer and most small to medium-sized agencies use to keep track of their billing hours and make sure that clients pay. And BlinkSale and PackRat, which was the most popular game on Facebook, both came out of Firewheel Design, which was Josh's parent, the company Josh founded before all this. And before that, well, really, let's go back to the beginning. Josh, how are you today?
Happy Friday. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
For throwing like heaps of kind praise on my head. You're much too kind. Far too kind.
What have you been eating?
I was telling you earlier about my I've got a steak and pork sandwich here from I'll throw this out to the Austin folks. I know people from Austin live here. There's a trailer on South Lamar called Municipal Taste. It's a newer trailer, probably a couple months old. They have a an amazing steak sandwich, an amazing pork sandwich. They also have a peanut butter, jalapeno jelly, and bacon and banana sandwich called the Velvet Elvis. So there's my
What else would you call it?
What's
the name of the place and what road is the truck usually located on?
It's called Municipal Taste, and it's on South Lamar, right around Mary. I think it's in front of a tire dealership there that's vacant. You know how things are here in Austin. It's just, you know, let's just throw a food truck in front of an old tire dealership and make it work. So you should look it up, Municipal Taste.
Now, Josh, you're a pretty fit guy, right? You bike, you climb mountains, I think you run. Is that correct?
I'd say like during the winter months, I try to, you know, ski and snowboard a little bit. So I tend to like go in and out of various stages of physical fitness. So if the weather's not kind, like during the summer, it was, you know, 120 degrees here in Austin, and I just didn't go outside. So I feel like lately I've been pretty much a lazy bump on the log. I'm gonna have to fix that, get back into the routine.
I mean, I ask that for two reasons. One is you just described a steak and pork sandwich, so I wanted to make sure that our listeners who are less physically active don't go, hey, that sounds... You know Greg Story, my partner at HappyCog, and I worry that Austin will kill him. So I think if you're going to partake
I heard the other day...
Go ahead.
No, I heard the other day that Austin has is like the... per capita eats out more than any other city in the United States. And I guess it makes sense. There's like, you know, generally a low cost of living here. So I would assume that equates to like a higher level of disposable income. And there's just a ton of fabulous places to eat at where you can dispose that income. And I feel like that's why they have all the running trails and the bike lanes here, is you've got to do something to get rid of the steak and pork sandwiches.
That's my point. I mean, Austin is a great, obviously great startup community. It's great creative and music community, an amazing city, in a strange and interesting state. But if you're not willing to do, you know, do the aerobics, I mean, you have to be careful. Usually when after I leave Austin, I've just groan for a couple of weeks just because I haven't...
The breakfast tacos and barbecue will bite you back.
How did you come to be in Austin? Were you born there?
No, I actually grew up in Dallas. My dad was born near Austin and grew up in a small town called New Braunfels, which is just south of Austin. So it's always been kind of, you know, familiar. My grandparents lived here for a while, and at some point, I think it made sense, as you know, our company was growing, to leave Dallas, which actually has a, you know, a decent creative and you know, tech culture there, but it's just a really big sprawling city, and so it didn't have the density, you know. So while it had you know, breadth, it didn't have, you know, necessarily the depth of, you know, just that feeling that you could walk down the street and run into, you know, people who were working on very interesting things. And so we ended up, you know, relocating to Austin at that point. And I really can't say enough, you know, wonderful things about this town. It's really one of the great cities in the U.S. and probably the world. You know, you start listing them out, there's a lot to like about this place.
Can you you know, Dallas reminds me in a way of L.A., right?
It's very much.
Wonderful tropical climate, great restaurants, very ambitious people, but it's very sprawling. It's very sprawling.
It is. And for that matter, I think Dallas very much has a Los Angeles complex. I think they, you know, wish, you know, in general that it could be more like L.A., a little bit more Hollywood, a little bit more glitz. And, you know, going to a Cowboys game or a Mavericks basketball game, you get a little taste of that. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just you talk about, again, a state like Texas. You have highly contrasting cities between Dallas and Austin and Houston and San Antonio.
Well, just at the risk of pissing off all our listeners, not just those in Dallas, I mean, used to be the Philadelphia had the same problem with New York, where Philadelphia is an awesome city in its own right, but people would feel somehow dwarfed by New York because it's so close, right? You'd be like, we're doing this amazing stuff, and be like, yeah, but they're doing more of it in New York. So Philadelphia is definitely coming into its own, and all these cities are wonderful. And of course, you're about to move, but I want to start with how you became the person you are, because I think, you know, one of the things we try to do on the show, sometimes I get people who are just starting, but very often I'll get people who, I mean, it's not like you're in the sunset of your career, you're you know, but you've already achieved quite a lot. A lot of times I'll get people who've achieved quite a lot, and I think we all wonder as we listen, aside from just having gifts, you know, having talents and maybe right place, right time, how did this person achieve so much? Because I also want to achieve. So let's start with how did you become an entrepreneur? You started at 19, correct?
Yeah, I did. And really, you know, it sounds, I don't want it to be overly cliche, but you really have to, I have to give a lot of credit back to my parents at various stages of my life. You know, they were, both my mom and my dad were entrepreneurs in different ways. They, I grew up on a landscape company. I mean, literally like a plant nursery with greenhouses and trees and, you know, shrubs and bushes and flowers and the like. And my parents, I mean, this is like predates Home Depot and Walmart before they had like nurseries and stuff. And so like in Dallas, like literally my life pretty much until my early teens revolved around spending my weekends working, you know, working on the at the nursery, which effectively was watering plants and pulling weeds and mowing lawns, and eventually guys like Home Depot, you know, did come in and kind of put the mom and pop, you know, businesses out of business, and my parents went into more residential, you know, landscape design at that point, and which ultimately ends up being a better business because it's more about craft and not necessarily about just, you know, selling flowers for profit. But I learned a ton just growing up in that, and you know, I think it demystified, you know, the starting your business, here's how it all works. And I think I learned just a lot about that process by osmosis. And
that's lucky. That's a huge break.
It really was. You know, and I think both my parents were artistic. My dad, much more in a esoteric, creative sort of way. My mom, actually, her degree was in medical illustration and photography, so she had a much more like formally trained art background, and so I grew up too seeing her art projects of like, here's my drawing of like a broken bone or somebody's gallbladder or an ear surgery that I witnessed, and that's kind of bizarre and honestly like really kind of disturbing art to stumble upon when you're a kid. But my parents were really talented, and I took a liking to art, and at some point I think when I was about 13 or 14, we had actually moved out to Taos, New Mexico, and there wasn't much of a school system there. And so at least for a period of time, my parents, you know, homeschooled me. You know, again, there's elementary but no high school, at least not within 45 minutes. So I spent the days like skiing and off hours doing school, and it was awesome if you were 13. But at some point, my mom had this revelation.
I'm sorry, one second. I just want to say, I see this being an influence on Gowalla, because, I mean, you conceived of Gowalla while you were sitting on a mountaintop wishing you could share the experience, right? So I see that you always had this sort of love of the outdoors and of going places that was encouraged from an early age, right?
Very much so, yeah. Okay. And I think at some point, you know, my mom recognizing kind of the love for art, and then also having an understanding of where technology was going, there was probably a place in my life where I could have pursued, you know, music, or could have pursued, you know, art a little bit more firmly. And my mom actually bought me a used Mac 2FX, and this was, wow, you know, early 90s. She bought it used for $3,000. They just put, like, kind of like wrap your head around that for a moment. So this was probably, the machine was probably 3 or 4 years old, and I'm sure had 30 megs of RAM in it, and, you know, but that's where I started, you know, learning Photoshop, and at the time it was, you know, Aldus PageMaker and all these tools that were, really early on. And so I spent, most of my teens just jacking around in ResEdit and Photoshop and PageMaker and Freehand, and I just loved it. And so my mom actually passed away when I was 18. She'd had, you know, cancer, and it was short notice and really rather brutal. And I ended up inheriting, you know, what was then the landscape company at that point, and I kind of ended up running it for, you know, a couple years after she passed. And I think my parents always knew that was never what I was going to do long term, but that was kind of like the final chapter of like, hey, here's instead of going to college, you get to run the family business for a couple years. And so I did that, and then was, you know, fortunately able to find someone who was more interested in running it than I was to kind of pass it along to, and then I jumped back into, you know, design full time, and decided to, you know, start my own company. And somewhere along the line,
you never did design for anyone else. You were never someone else's employee.
Yeah, through high school, I volunteered at a number of places, basically just mainly nonprofits. Just to learn the trade. I worked for an organization that did a lot of traditional like print media for the public school system. And so literally over a period of years, in my late teens, just volunteering, I probably designed close to 2,000 pages of school curriculum. Wow. Trust me, it was rough. But it was a really great learning process. Yeah. And some of it was fun, some of it was artistic, some of it was like, here's how you figure out what the, you know, the Quark Express keyboard commands are. And, you know, you do enough of that, and you really start to gain a vision for, you know, what you enjoy and what you like to do. And during that time, a friend of mine, kind of convinced me that HTML was going to be kind of this hot thing. And so, you know, somewhere around, you know, 97 in my late teens, I decided to start moving away from, you know, kind of the traditional graphic design and more into the web stuff. And that, of course, that turned out to be fortuitous advice.
Yep. I started working on a children's clothing catalog, so I can totally relate to.
Yeah.
And when you have to, I think when you have to churn stuff out, you can't really agonize. It's not like you're going to do this one beautiful thing and you can agonize over it for 6 months and it's got to be perfect. It's more like you have to produce and produce and produce and produce. And I think deadlines are great.
It is. And actually, you mentioned that, and it makes me think, too, like, you know, prior to a lot of this print stuff, I had started, you know, again, this is Dallas. I started, you know, volunteering like a day or two a week at, you know, one of the larger mega churches there. And this was at a time before, like, video production or any of that sort of thing. And so literally you imagine, you know, instead of full motion, I guess now it's been replaced by stuff like Keynote and PowerPoint and whatnot. But back then, like literally, you know, for whether they're writing the words to a hymn on a, you know, up on the screen, it was all actually shot to film. And so we were using, at the time, it was Adobe Persuasion. Which is another one of these pieces of software that time forgot. And again, you talk about deadlines. So you have a Sunday that happens, you know, every Sunday, and you've got to have, you know, new slides up there with, again, words for hymns or scripture references or whatever the case may be. And that's got to go up on the screen. And that has to be image to film, which is like a really slow process. And you literally, the slide processor was this big, long, you know, kind of, you know, chunky laser printer size machine with a camera body on the back of it. And you load slide film into that thing and it would image, you know, straight off your machine, you know, onto film. And then you go develop the film the deadlines of like doing that sort of stuff week in and week out, you know, for a couple years. You learn a lot of tricks of the trade that way, and it's interesting to look back, because that's like there's these very like tactile traditional sides of design that, you know, if you would kind of want to wax and go rough kids these days, they don't know.
No, the kids. I was just thinking. You said Res Edit, right? I was still geeking out about Res Edit before you even got to Adobe Persuasion, but we might as well be talking ancient Sanskrit. I mean,
just about.
It's
yeah.
These are things that nobody who's getting started now will ever experience. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the whole thing about cassette mixes, and we use cassette decks as imagery for a mix, but nobody growing up now actually knows what that is. Or we use the floppy disk icon, but nobody really knows what that even means. They know it means save your data here, but they don't know why, because they didn't have 5.5-inch floppies and 3.5-inch. They didn't know why 3.5-inch was more awesome than 5.5. So it is fun to have grown up with, you know, the start of this technology. Right. And
oh, absolutely.
When did you?
Of course, you know, I have the. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask. You have this illustration background, which you get from your mom, and you have, you know, entrepreneurial. When did you become an iconist? Because I think when I first became aware of you, you were winning Icon Factory's Pixelpalooza year after year, I believe, is what that's how you got started, right? You kept winning Pixelpalooza. Yeah.
Well, so part of that was it actually kind of came out of, you know, dinking around in Res Edit. And you know, I think there's a point when I was mid-teens, I got into, like, resource editing. And of course, like, the holy grail is trying to figure out how do you most system icons were easy to just dive in to Res Edit and change. And you could, you know, click off the pixels and do whatever you wanted to with them.
Right.
But the trash can was the one that was they had that resource was on lockdown. And to actually, like, get deep enough into the system resources to edit the trash can icon was a real, you know, was a real chore. And I nearly lost a job that way because I trashed a machine. I deleted some, you know, resource forks that shouldn't have been deleted in the middle of trying to edit a trash can icon to make it look like who knows what. I'm sure I was trying to, like, you know, make it look like Oscar was popping out of it or something when it was full. But, you know, you know, I remember doing that in my teens, and then it really was about the time I was 19 or 20, you know, became a fan of Icon Factory's work, and then it was like, oh, really, there's this contest too, and that's awesome. And I kind of stumbled onto it by accident. Those guys were really influential, and I think kind of giving me a platform, you know, for my work early on. Again, that was kind of like really, it was still early days of the web. Yep. And, you know, back when icons were 32 pixels and it was a really small, you know, tight knit community. And I ended up, of course, meeting all the Icon Factory guys, but, you know, a dozen of other, you know, now fairly influential or well-known, you know, iconists, several of whom I've had the pleasure of working with right. over the past several years.
You hired Brian, who became a big yeah. part of Gowalla, right? Brian Basher.
Yeah, so Ether Brian Brasher, and then John Marstall was one of the others, and both of those guys were really involved, you know, in the Pixelpalooza community, and that's how I met both of them. And they were, you know, the three of us effectively were the guys that were, you know, at Firewheel when it all got started.
When you started Firewheel,
you know,
and started making icon sets. So again, before Packrat, before Blink Sale, before Gowalla, one of the first things you did, you started. Making icon sets, and they were great, but at the same time, because I'd known the Icon Factory guys for so long and I had loyalty, I was really torn. When I would look at your work, I would go, this is great, I'd like to, but if I were to buy this, would I be being disloyal to my friends at Icon Factory? And I imagine I wasn't the only freak who thought that way. I imagine that there was, you know, I mean, we all encourage each other, but then it's like we're friendly competitors. I'm probably not explaining what I'm trying to get at, but did you very well. But was there tension or hostility? Did you feel bad when you started, or were you surprised by the response you got, or did everything go down smoothly?
I think ultimately everything went down smoothly. You know, it was, you know, at the time Icon Factory was really growing. And when I got started early on, they were actually refer projects to me that they weren't able to take on just due to capacity and stuff. And,
right.
And
they
so,
were doing
in a lot of
all
ways,
of Microsoft's icons. And so they would be like, well, we got to do all of Microsoft's operating systems. So give the kid here something. Right.
Yeah, basically. And so, you know, I owe them a lot of gratitude for, like I said, giving me a little bit of a platform early on. And gratefully, I feel like I know there's the occasional project that we ended up competing over when it was all said and done. But the industry itself grew, and, you know, the web grew and software grew. And ultimately, I feel like there was, you know, obviously plenty of work to go around, and no one ever really suffered. And what's ironic in the end is I think both of us, you know, have found that, again, some of the greatest joy has truly come from working on your own projects, you know, beyond just the client work, whether it was us ultimately doing something like Blink Sale or then Packrat and Gowalla or what they've gone on to do with Forensic and, you know, a ton of their, you know, delightful, you know, iOS work.
Right.
And I feel like it's neat to see how, again, the community just kind of grown over the years. I do miss the Pixelpalooza days, though. Sometimes I wish they'd bring it back. I could use a diversion every now and then to actually, you know, go back and draw some stuff. Maybe they'd let me participate.
Yep. So what was the trajectory from basically doing icon sets to developing something like Packrat at Facebook? When did you guys go, you know what, we should just, the web's nice, but let's focus on Facebook? Because you made that decision pretty early on.
We did, and part of that is, you know, we'd done this site called Icon Buffet that was kind of right. like, you know, a site for us to parlay just our pure icon work through. And it had this weird kind of addictive trading mechanic where you couldn't collect all the icons unless you traded them back and forth with other designers or other developers, other people on the site. And long about the same time we did that, I actually kind of stumbled into a friendship with Sean Parker of Napster and, you know, then early Facebook, you know, fame. And of course, Sean is now been, you know, portrayed by Timberlake and,
right.
and Hollywood films. And he's certainly nothing really like what the movie makes him out to be. But Sean took an early liking to our work, and we had an opportunity to work on a handful of projects with him. And he was probably one of the guys early on that said, hey, I really love this Icon Buffet thing. But would you imagine it like just as a pure game on Facebook? And it kind of got us, you know, scratching our heads and said, well, why not? Why don't we just try this? And we had a team of 6 or 7 people at the time, and we built it. This was, you know, Facebook had just opened up, you know, their platform. This is about 4+ years ago. Right. And of course, all the early apps on Facebook were, or at least the games were, you know, vampires and werewolves and bite your friends, and it was just kind of like this chintzy, you know, viral loops type stuff that didn't have a lot of value. And so we built Packrat, and it was kind of the first, you know, game, if you will, that actually had some depth and some strategy. And it was basically a card collecting and trading game. It was fairly simple, but it found an audience and became, you know, a cult hit for a period of time. And I think it surprised us, and you know, ultimately it led us to, you know, led us on the journey to build Gowalla. And I think with Packrat, what we found is we built this thing that we'd used artwork to, you know, create a certain type of behavior. In this case, it involved like sitting people in front of a screen all day long and having them trade and swap these cards, which is fun. But I guess with Gowalla, like, the thought process became, now we've got these mobile devices and there's a different platform. How can we use, you know, art and design to inspire people to get outside and to see, you know, different parts of the world, to explore places in a new way? And that's where, you know, kind of that transition happened. And at times I look back and I feel like there's probably, you know, we could have continued developing on Packrat or even made more games on Facebook platform at the time. And the type of company that we would have ended up building, you know, could have looked, you know, remarkably different from the one that we have now.
Right.
I'm really excited that we kind of jumped into something a little bit more on the edge, and we ended up, you know, kind of in this great space along with the, you know, the guys at Foursquare and some others that were really doing unique things as it related to location and getting people again to go out and share their experiences and share their photos and their stories from, you know, the places that they're at. And I still feel like that whole space, you know, and hopefully, you know, some of the things we're going to get to go on and keep working on at Facebook is still really, really, really early. And in a lot of ways, we've all still been held back by the technology just a little bit. In terms of the things that we'd like to be able to do with location and photos and these stories and what we've actually been able to do due to, you know, battery life on phones and accuracy of, you know, GPS and the like. And so I feel like the future's still really bright, and we'll look back, I think, on stuff like Gowalla and Foursquare perhaps in a lot of the same ways, you know, that we look back on ResEdit and Adobe Persuasion at this point.
Do you think the check-in is going to become more just part of some other thing? Like, you also check in on Instagram, but you're taking a picture, or you also check in on food spotting, but you're sharing food. Do you think the... I know that you, at a certain point, you... in Gowalla, you walked away from the icon trading, the thing that had initially been, let's take our icon trading, right, as you just described it, let's take our icon trading, but let's let people be active, let's not keep them trapped in a cubicle at a desktop, let's use mobile apps. Then you got rid of that, and it just became about the check-in. Do you think, and I know you tried to do something about that with stories, but I'm just wondering if you think when we look, that check-ins are just going to be a ubiquitous part of how we do everything, and less an app in their own right.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I feel like, and I think that Instagram was perhaps maybe the first app or service that got really broad adoption that started to prove that point to a degree. And I think they tapped into kind of this, you know, visceral experience of looking at these, you know, wonderful photos. And back in the, you know, the early days of Instagram, all of, what was that, 12 or 13 months ago, we were all following, you know, Dan Rubin and all of his, you know, photos that he was, you know, throwing up on Instagram. And then you realize that that location was often a real core part of what these, you know, these photos that were being shared. And I think that they you know, started showing that there's more to location than just the, you know, the raw intersection of a person and a place. And I think everybody in the space kind of gets that now and, you know, saw that coming some time ago. But I do think that it's going to mean you're going to start to see a little bit more of an evolution, whether it's for, you know, where location just kind of becomes this layer that can be attached at times if you want to any sort of, you know, media that's being, you know, shared or uploaded or whatnot. And I guess
Path is doing that.
Yeah. Path is starting to.
I think you were heading in that direction with Story, right?
Yes.
And what happened, but I think Path are the ones now sort of pursuing that direction of, I'm uploading a film, I'm uploading music, I'm telling you what song I like, and maybe I'm listening to that song at a place with a friend, maybe
exactly,
I'm just listening to
exactly.
it. Right.
And their interface for doing that is quite delightful. And it was neat to see. I feel like we were starting to push the ball, you know, in that direction a good bit. And we did to a degree, but there's some, you know, honestly, we look at it ourselves and like, there's some things we did right. And there's some things that were the UX and the experience was just not as polished as we wanted it to be.
That's always true, I feel though. Like, that's always
yeah,
true.
Yeah. I mean, and I feel like Path did some really sharp things in improving upon some of those same concepts. But I still feel like there's, like I said, it's just the early days and we're all just, kind of banging away on, kind of some really, really difficult problems. Like one of the ones for us that we were always, that we were really keen on trying to solve is kind of like the, you know, the event or the wedding reception, right. You know, problem where what happens when I upload photos and you upload photos and 13 other people upload photos and we effectively create, you know, 15 different records of a check-in at an event and all those, none of those photos are really kind of related or there's not, you know, a tie that allows me to see them as a cohesive, you know, group. And that was something we were trying to solve, and we did an okay job at it, but it wasn't fabulous. The experience was still needed a lot of work.
That's what you were going
that's
for
one
with
that
Story.
I still feel
again.
Like it's,
yeah,
yeah,
and it hasn't been solved yet.
But no, it hasn't. And I'm in hopes that we're going to get to keep playing around with stuff like that.
Yeah, you're off to Facebook, where you may have an opportunity to solve problems exactly like that.
I think the exciting thing. Oh, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, Facebook is very development driven. I would say, you know, and experience driven, not particularly design driven. And you and your team are just a huge group of extremely talented designers who are, you know, thinking, exciting, very talented designers. And I'm just wondering. If, although you can't talk about what you're doing, if we can expect design to play a larger role in Facebook.
I think if you look at Facebook's, you know, more recent string of acquisitions, you see companies like ours, and then you see folks like Sofa and Nick Felton and some of the there have been a lot of design driven, you know, or even the Push Pop Press guys, very design focused companies that they've brought in, and I think this speaks to an awareness that as the company grows up, and you look at a company like say Apple as an archetype that design does have to play an increasingly important role in the lifespan of the company. I think they've always had really talented designers there. I think as a percentage of the overall product team, though, it's been rather small. And right. I think that there's obviously much more product there that needs to be designed, needs to be envisioned that way. And I think that's the excitement of that opportunity. But again, somebody I don't have the link in front of me right now, so I'm totally going to butcher it. But there was an article that I saw that kind of hit Twitter this morning that it was basically something to the effect of, you know, design's not, you know, not terribly important, or is actually overrated right now for early stage startups. And it was interesting because it was obviously sensationalist, and there was a little bit of intentional kickback there. But it made the point that, like, we heralded Apple for being a really design driven company, but the first Apple computers were literally just built in wooden boxes. And I think that it may be missing the point that there's still craft involved there, and Jobs was obviously, I think, the consummate product person. But I feel like that, you know, as Facebook is growing, they find themselves kind of in that same place of, like, we built this thing, and how do we move beyond, you know, the wooden box now into, you know, kind of this next generation of being a fairly grown-up company.
That's a great place to leave it. I hope we'll speak again, maybe in another 6 months or a year. Where can folks look for you? You're JW on Twitter.
Correct.
Where else?
That's the easiest place. Okay. JW on Twitter, at least. That's the one. And JW on Facebook, for that matter, too. Those are the two constants in my life at this point are those two addresses. And, you know, other than that, everything else is a little bit in flux.
To be continued. Thank you for your time today, sir.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Happy holidays.
Likewise. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.